Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe. And I'm delighted to have three fantastic speakers here today. But in the midst of happiness, we're in sadness because we have lost our very dear gentleman of the road, Wilfred Diath, who sadly died last week, aged 82. He was also a terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes and did a runner from countless hotels. But the point was, he was our terrible old rogue who stole from church collection boxes. And he was a fantastic columnist because he had the crucial element of a columnist of complete and utter honesty about his own terrible shortcomings. But he was a great, great friend to the oldie and a wonderful columnist, and I always try to print one letter saying, you must get rid of this disgusting man, and another letter saying he is an utter genius, and both were true. So he'll be much missed, Wilfred. We're also very sad in the oldie office to say goodbye to our dear friend Emily Steer, who is leaving the oldie, who has been keeping Oldie Towers alive for the last couple of years. But on a happier note, I can introduce you to the world's greatest, funniest MC, Mr. Barry Cryer. Yeah.
I've just noticed what was on the menu. Forced Yorkshire rhubarb. I'm from Leeds. Nobody forces us to do anything. Yorkshireman who loved his wife so much, he once told her. Now, I'm wondering already. Oh, I heard a thing on the radio the other day, Trump in Japan, and somebody mentioned Pearl Harbor. He denied ever meeting her. I ask our authors to bear with me if they're not aware of this. A lot of you are. Our convention, before I introduce them, the parrot joke. And as always, I say, if you're tempted to join in, please don't. It spoils it for the few who haven't heard it. Woman went into a shop and saw a beautiful gold parrot. And she said to the man, how much? He said, 20 quid, 20 pounds. He said, 20 pounds? He's gorgeous. He said, well, I've got to be honest with you, he's got form, he's got history. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She thought, 20 pounds, take a chance on that. And she took it back to the flat, and she took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And her two daughters walked in, and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in, and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, we move on. Our next author tells a tale of our capital in terms of walks both long and little, a strenuous saga of strides and hikes, no cars, no buses, tubes or bikes, just lakes and where they both can take you. Around London, and he can make you want to join him rank by rank. Welcome to our Shanks's Pony Man, Dan Cruikshank.
That was very good, thank you. I really got to follow it. Thank you very much. Yes, my book about London, I have got some images. So goodness knows how you at the back will see anything. So I have to describe them, I suppose. A book about London. Well, those of you who see the book will see it's a very fat... Oh, you can see nothing over there. Hang on. Maybe I'll go over here. You will see it's a very fat book. So 10 minutes. Many people have written about London, of course, over the years. I mean, Daniel Defoe is pretty good. He calls it this great monstrous thing over my shoulder. London in the 1720s. London's population was then 680,000, I think. Monstrous then, impossible now. 9 million people
live in this city. The city's boundaries, of course, have changed since the 18th century. But nevertheless, London is a small nation in itself, we know that. An organism of great complexity, as big as some nations, as big as New Zealand, for example. So it's a madness, in a way, to try and write about such a thing. Why did I do it? Because I'm a Londoner. And as Londoners do, I love London, as I'm sure you do. It's a strange, compelling thing to try and deal with this great city. And of course, the book is a life's work in a way. I was born in London. I've traveled much. I lived abroad, but I live in London now. So it's something I've experienced. And those who love London know the strange things it does to you. It's one of the world's great cities, a city where you can always be surprised. The first time I should say I wrote about London was 45 years ago. My first book was 45 years ago, so I have some authority. I therefore am probably the oldest oldie here. Well, if I stand here, that's better, but then you can see, okay. Good. So, London, the great challenge. So it's a book of observations. Walks, well, walks are, it may seem a bit tacky walks, but in a way, walks are rather brilliant. They give a structure, and they give a chance to enjoy one of the great things of a great city like London, a city that's evolved over a long period. The juxtaposition of things. Walks are unforgiving. You have to deal with the buildings you see on the walk. You can dictate the walk to a degree, but nevertheless, buildings arise. So you have to deal with this wonderful thing of juxtapositions. Also, of course, it's become a rather topical subject now. The book appeared end of last year, and we have the mayor's election in May, don't we? So a good moment to force us to reflect upon London. We are going to vote for the next mayor. The mayor has certain powers. I mean, the former mayor used those powers in a rather draconian way in development, overturning planning permissions that are rejected and putting, in autocratic way, permissions in their place. The mayor of this city is a political creature. So therefore, you know, I say that if we think about what the mayor is to do, it leads us to think about the nature of our city, which leads us naturally to think about history. And in this book, I have identified some of the historical natures of London, some of the key things about it. Obvious point to make, as all the, no doubt, the contenders will be making, it is a city of diversity. Well, okay, diversity is a throwaway word, but it is true. It is that. The community of people who have come and settled here, from the 17th century in particular, the Huguenot Calvinists in the late 17th century, starting the silk industry, the Jewish community in the late 19th century, these have defined London as Bangladesh is now. So the book does deal with these, or tackles, or confronts and investigates these characteristics. The other great thing about London, of course, if one thinks about the London that we want, is that there are things to be learned from the past, of course. It is, a cliche, a great place of villages. Village identity is important still. There is Chelsea, there is Spitalfields, there are the other places of London, Covent Garden. If we go back 100 years before the LCC was created, you know, the London was run as villages with vestries and parishes and so on and so forth. It's an opportunity now to re-explore that, you know, the way we govern our city. If we want identity and responsibility for our areas and security and so on and pride, again, this is something one can look at. The lessons that history can teach about how the city was. So I say it is a sort of a strange juxtaposition doing walks, and I suppose other points I wanted to make here. Of course, change my images. So, doing the book for many years, but intensely the last year or so, I was shocked to a degree. I mean, yes, diversity, yes, many all the other things about that are famous about London, but also change, a city of change. It is not a city of preciousness. It's not a city like Bath or Edinburgh Newtown where there is a distinct, overwhelming architectural character. It is one of diversity of architecture and of people. But my God, the rate of change now makes one think, okay, maybe it's my age. I've known London a long time. But the changes afoot now are frightening to a degree, and I put them in historical context and perspective, but the speed, the scale, the quality of change is now something which is very, 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 very shocking. Oh, I'll just show you the Strand. I'll come back to the Strand in a moment. High rise. I mean, I've just, on my walks, these 13 walks, And of course, the walks are curious because they are chosen to be emblematic and to represent things. You can't cover the whole city in walks. There'd be volumes and volumes. There has to be one book. So my walks are chosen to represent aspects, characteristics of the city and be emblematic in that way. I do one walk. Some are meandering, some are direct, linear kind of walks. One big walk in several parts is from edge of the Roman city, Bishopsgate in the north of London, through the city of London, along Fleet Street and the Strand, bringing me here. And on that walk, going through the heart of Mammon of the city, the return of high rise, either mostly commercial, no housing aspect, so not social housing. One of the great issues of the city now is social housing. Their commercial towers are rising. So we're going back to a transformation of London. High rise is okay, except of course it has a tremendous effect on all around it. The sentiment expressed here, street artists are bastards. That may or may not be true, written obviously by a street artist. But nevertheless, what is true is this great tower at the beginning of the Bishopsgate Walk is 50 stories high, designed by Norman Foster. Luxury flats, the ones of top are being sold for £8 million and they're empty. No one's investing in such things. It doesn't help London. Other schemes that have arisen in the last few weeks, almost, the book came out last year, but you know, it's constant change, constant reminder of London's changing character, changeful nature. There's a scheme here in East London. This is a very nice pub on Commercial Street, nice 1860s pub. This is what's proposed. This is familiar. Oldies like me get tired of such things. I've been involved in fighting and arguing or questioning such developments. It's all luxury flats and high-rise offices for 50 years now. Nothing changes. So any experience of London, any book about London, has got to be, to a degree, a lament, because change happens and often not for the better. And I say, interesting political moment, because if we are concerned, the mayor's election in May is an opportunity for us to get these characters to answer, to explain what they're going to do and make clear what we want. And so it goes on. Going back, So it's a book of stories, of course, in a sense, book of stories about London, organisers' walks. I happen to be here today, by chance, on the Strand. The Strand is one of my walks, as I said. This building is one of my buildings, as it happens. So I did just a couple of stories about this building, where we are. Those who can see this map, and those who can't, I'll explain. The first London map is quite not very old, actually, 1555, the so-called copperplate map. This is soon after that. The copperplate map is only two sections of it survive, 1555. This is Braun and Hogenberg's map of 1572, and it shows London at a crucial moment. And this is where we are, of course. Famously, London is these two things historically. The city of London, which was a Roman city, the medieval city here, with its wall and the Tower of London here, the Thames, and the other worlds, the South London, another place entirely. Well, it actually is, of course, Surrey. Those who go there occasionally know you still feel it's like a different place, don't you? And it was out of the control of the city of London and so on and so forth, became theatre land because it was out of the control of the city corporation. And then Royal Westminster, the city of Westminster, palaces and parliaments and so on. And here we are on the Strand, the Strand being a place of palaces. Interesting, the Strand, actually. Here we see it linking the city and Westminster in the 1570s. Aristocratic houses here, because aristocratic houses were scattered around London on the edge, often on the edge, a lot in Bishopsgate, just outside the walls in the east up here. Famously, all we now can see, obviously, is Somerset House. Government buildings from the 18th century, but once of course a royal palace, whole series of great palaces along the Strand here, and famously the Savoy Palace here, 12th century, a fragment survives of course, the chapel just behind us here, late 15th century, early 16th century, the Queen's Chapel, that was once a royal palace, the Palace of Savoy. This map shows it. So this great highway connecting London, obviously also famous, as a highway of the sex industry was very big in 18th century London. I wrote a book about it some time ago, Secret History of Georgian London, and the Strand was part of this great sexual highway. Now I haven't got time, sadly, to give you any stories about that, but they are in the book on page. I give you the page number. So buy it. Boswell and Defoe are very good about the street life of Fleet Street and the Strand in the 18th century. But just my last few moments, just to reflect, there's a story. So randomly, I've not chosen this story. The story's chosen me because I happen to be here today. There's a voice. It is a sensational story. You're probably aware of it. If there's time, I would love to tell you about the Communist Party occupation of the Savoy Hotel in September the 18th, 1940, but there isn't probably time for that. But broadly speaking, well, at the end, if you give me the opportunity. So, it's a reminder, of course, the money to be made in the late 19th century out of comic operas. I mean, Gilbert and Sullivan funded all this. Richard Doyle Carr was the impresario, and he made a lot of money from their productions. And that money was used to build the Savoy Theatre, 1881. First production there was Patience. That was enough for them, their association, Gilbert Sullivan, the popularity of their comic operettas, funded the theatre, 1881. And a few years later, the Mikado was a gigantic hit, 1885. And the money from that was used to start the Savoy Hotel by Doyle Card. He, in 1898, bought the going concern, Simpsons. It started as a cigar divan and coffee house in 1828. Coffee house was very popular. And it flourished and became famous as a place of dining in the mid-19th century. And it introduced the idea of rolling great hunks of beef around on silver carts. Still happens downstairs, I think. And you have your slice of meat. Very popular dining establishment. And John Simpson bought in 1850, I think, and set it up. So it flourished, and Doyle Carr bought it in 1898 and added it to his empire funded by Gilbert and Sullivan Productions. The building's fascinating. The Savoy gets going, and it flourishes. The whole thing about these grand hotels in the late 19th century are fascinating. Parisian-style American comfort and convenience. The Savoy is one of the first London hotels to actually achieve that plateau of excellence. Doesn't do well initially, there are problems. And indeed, Richard Doyle Carr died in 1901, but his son takes it over, Rupert, and it goes on. The hotel becomes important. This building gets rebuilt. This is time's up. Okay, I knew it wouldn't be long enough. Don't forget the communists, sorry. All I'm going to say about this building is rebuilt in 1905 as part of the whole rebuild, as part of the styling of the area related to the Savoy. This room, in the Adam style it was called, was for ladies. Until the 1980s, I think ladies could not dine downstairs. No, gentlemen only. Ladies were up here in his elegant Adam decoration. However, the stories abound in the book. This is one cut short by time. I'm so sorry about the communists, never mind. Another time I'm invited back. Very good stories. Savoy rose to the challenge. I'm going to stop now. My 10 minutes or more is up. Sorry. Thank you very much.